A quote from Tricky Dicky: every one of the bastards that are out for legalising marijuana is Jewish. What the Christ is the matter with the Jews? I suppose it is because most of them are psychiatrists. That's the quote that begins the book we're about to discuss. And it's great to have Anthony Lowenstein back with us. The last time I spoke to him was in 2009 about the crisis in Gaza. He's now based in Jerusalem, and he writes for the New York Times, The Guardian, The Beeb, The Washington Post, The Nation, and HuffPost. So one thing and another, he's pretty busy. He's an advocate of the legalization and regulation of all drugs, as am I, and his latest book is Pills, Powder and Smoke: Inside the Bloody War on Drugs, published by our friends at Scribe. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Phil.
Anthony, you describe the war on drugs as a failed policy. Well, that I think is an understatement by orders of magnitude. And that eradicating drug trafficking was never its aim. What was its aim? Unveil the conspiracy.
When I say in the beginning of the book it's a failed policy, I also say in the paragraph after, it depends how you define success. So has it succeeded, in inverted commas, in monitoring and surveilling minorities? Yes. Has it achieved that by incarcerating huge numbers of people? Yes. Initially, the so-called drug war, long before Richard Nixon was even in the White House, was about the fear that many white populations had in places like Australia, the US and elsewhere, that white women were going to be defiled by Mexicans using marijuana, or Chinese in Australia here using opium to defile white virgin girls. That was the narrative, written about in mainstream publications, spoken by politicians. So it wasn't called the war on drugs back in 1910, but that was where it really began, I would say. And so the fear of minorities, the racism against minorities, fast forward to the last 40 years. And I say in the book, really across the world, I go to Honduras and West Africa and Philippines and elsewhere, that the death toll from the drug war is really inarguably the worst of any major war of the last half century.
Let's give some figures. So, in Mexico, Central America,
yes,
how many have died?
Likely millions. I mean, no one knows is the short answer, but millions. I mean, Mexico is a good example. Mexico this year, the first half of the year, it was the highest death toll ever recorded in Mexico, which is not solely about the drug war, but a lot to do with the drug war. I mean, really, this is about, Philip, the fact that demand for drugs has never been high. The amount of people who are taking drugs around the world, illegal drugs, talking about methamphetamines, cocaine, etc., marijuana, which is still illegal in many countries, the demand for the drug is massive. And that those drugs have to get to people somehow. So what I was trying to do in the book was to, A, go to these places where the drugs are either being farmed or trafficked, Honduras, Guinea-Bissau, West Africa, and look at who exactly are the people providing these drugs to people in Sydney or London or New York, and is there, what's the supply chain, where has it come from, and who are the civilians who are being affected? And secondly, why is this drug war continuing when on any sensible metric it's a failure? And yet, as I said, on the other hand, you could argue that in fact it's been very successful in decimating, particularly in the US, vast generations of African Americans and Hispanics.
Ellie Nell on RN, and my guest is journalist, author Anthony Lowenstein. He's the author of Pills, Powder and Smoke: Inside the Bloody Wars on Drugs, published by Scribe. Now, on a simple level, we see what the drug laws, the drug wars and the idiotic drug laws that they've produced create. It criminalises millions of people. It turns a health problem into a criminal problem. It overcrowds prisons. It corrupts almost the entire system involved in interdiction and prohibition, doesn't it? It just goes on and on and on. Has it had any success whatsoever in reducing consumption, or has it simply increased prices and been a boon to the cartels?
Yes, is the very short answer to that question. Has it been a success in any way? Well, in any Western country, if you look at it, the rate of drug use in the last 20, 30 years, not all drugs, but most drugs use, in fact, is soaring. In the UK, for example, I spent time in the UK. There are sections of that country in the north of the country. I went to Newcastle, where there are literally now, Philip, generations of people who have massive problems with heroin amongst other drugs. And that's simply not because drugs are widely available, though they are. It's obviously a connection to the political reality. So the Conservatives have been in power in the UK for 10 or so years. And what you find as a result of that is harsh austerity has cut massive social programs. So there, you go to housing estates in Newcastle. This is near the centre of a beautiful English city. And you have literally generations of kids who have no opportunities because drugs have become a central normal part of life. Overdoses in the UK has never been high. Just 2 weeks ago, they released figures that Scotland now has one of the highest rates of overdose deaths in the world. And despite that, in the UK, and I would argue often in Australia and parts of the US, there is a refusal. I think this is, in some ways, it's actually a moral failure. It's obviously a political failure as well and a police failure. It's a moral failure because the drug war is framed, has always been framed as a moral fault. You're on heroin, you're a failure. You're a bad person, you're an evil person. When in fact, some people who take drugs, sure, there are bad people who take drugs, of course. This is a health issue. It's a problem that people are interested in resolving. And also, I think what I'm trying to do is change the conversation to say the vast majority of people who take drugs, illicit substances, have no problem, enjoy it, want to do it, in my view, have the right to do it. There is a tiny percentage of people, 5 to 10% in most places, that might have some problem with drugs, overuse, addiction, whatever it may be, for a range of reasons. And then I argue that legalizing and regulating drugs, all drugs, doesn't somehow resolve societal problems. I'm not saying that. People will still be depressed and whatever. But I think what it does is it treats society as adults, not children. And it says, and there's some encouraging news, as I say in the book, and you would know, and listeners would know, public opinion actually has shifted on this in the last 10 years, that most studies around
public
the world...
Public opinion's always been more progressive on this on issue so many than issues. Political opinion.
I agree. But the difference in the last 10 years in much of the world is that public policy has followed. It was unimaginable 20 years ago, for example, that US states would legalize marijuana. It's now very conceivable that a US president, probably not Donald Trump, but a Democrat president, most of the Democrat candidates who are running at the moment in the US for 2020, many of them, not all, support legalizing marijuana. They support reparations for the drug war. They support investing huge amounts of money back into the communities that have been affected. So there's a shift going on, and public opinion is there.
You don't eulogise Obama, but to some extent he tried to start changing the conversation.
He did, and I do say that in the book, that Obama on most issues, I would argue, was a follower rather than a leader, not least on issues of, say, same-sex relationships and drugs, and he came to this party too late. But he did put in place a policy that released about 1,700 people who were in prisons for often life sentences for low-level, non-violent drug crimes. Those people were released, and I met some of them in the book, people who would have died in prison otherwise. One of the important things that Obama did was allowed US states that legalized marijuana. They weren't prosecuted by the federal government. And also what he did was, when countries around the world moved to talk about legalizing marijuana, talked about legalizing other drugs, he did not as much, not didn't stop it, as much as previous administrations push for a very harsh, you know,
I think it's
policy.
Important to understand that the Americans have pushed hard on governments like our own to maintain the war.
They pushed hard on it, and Australia generally, like on so many issues, has been a follower, not a leader. But it's important to say, and I'd say this in the book, that Sydney and Melbourne have the only safety injecting facilities in the Southern Hemisphere. Still, Sydney, of course, was first. Melbourne, obviously, now is second. And in those facilities, lives have been saved. And that's not me saying it. That's no one's ever died in those facilities. And what I am calling for is
harm minimization programs.
Totally. It should be ice consumption rooms. And one thing which I'd love a government to do in Australia and other places is there needs to be ministers for happiness. A minister for happiness would deal with a range of issues, not least, I would say, how a society deals with drugs, depression, mental health, and why so many people in our society are depressed, unhappy, dissatisfied. It's not just because of drugs, obviously, it's for a range of reasons. And I know you've had people on the program before talking about this, but it's conceivable in years to come that you're going to go to a doctor and get prescribed ecstasy or LSD or magic mushrooms, which is helping people.
We've had people on the program urging that LSD be now seen as a very useful medication.
And it can be. And it's important to note that if that was used for medical reasons, it would be done in a controlled environment in a doctor's surgery rather than just someone using acid at home. But absolutely, that's the change. And I think.
But Anthony, we've got Trump doubling down. He's arguing or urging that drug dealers now face the death penalty.
Well, Trump is inspired by people who he's inspired by Duterte in the Philippines, and I spent time there, and who's killed probably 30,000 people in 2.5 years. That's true, Philip. And if Trump wins next year, you're not likely to see radical improvements. That's true. But as I said, you didn't have in the 2016 election leading Democratic candidates talking about legalizing marijuana and at least reassessing the drug war. And I think one of the effects for me has been to go to all these places, particularly Guinea-Bissau, the Philippines and Honduras, to see the effect that these policies have on people there that doesn't get talked about enough in the West.
Okay, in the time we've got, take us to Honduras and Guinea-Bissau.
So briefly, Honduras obviously is a neighbour of the US. Most of the cocaine getting into the US is going via Honduras from Colombia and Venezuela. The effect of that is that Honduras is racked by violence. There's a reason why Honduras has one of the highest murder rates in the world outside a traditional war zone. And the reason why so many people are fleeing to try to get into Trump's America is because the country is literally falling apart. I was spending time with people who, there's something called a war tax there. Anyone who wants to run a business from a stall at the side of the road to driving a bus to opening a shop has to pay a war tax, a weekly fee to gangs. One gang, two gangs, and if you don't, they will kill you. It's literally as simple as that. And the effect of the last 30 years on Honduras policy is that successive governments there have allowed the US to militarize the country to such an extent that the country essentially is not just a narco state, so essentially it's run and controlled by narcos, and the leadership of the country, including the current president, has been funded by drugs. And I think the effect of that has been that the US has been willing and happy to allow countries like that, since particularly Reagan, but before that as well, was started in some ways actually under Carter, that a country like Honduras to collapse. And then we wonder why so many people are fleeing. And so much of the media coverage that's really annoyed me about the refugee crisis in the US says people are fleeing Honduras. Why are they fleeing Honduras? What policies from Washington is causing that? You often don't get that reasoning.
Guinea-Bissau
is in a country that virtually no one's heard of, West Africa, former Portuguese colony, tiny country, doesn't have the kind of violence that's destroying Honduras, but a lot of the cocaine going into Europe goes through Guinea-Bissau from South America. So cartels are sending drugs through Guinea-Bissau by plane and boat into Europe. And cocaine use in Europe, particularly the UK, is going through the roof. So you've had successive governments in Guinea-Bissau run as narco states. The UN has called it a narco state. So again, one of the things I'm calling for in the book, and I'm not the only one doing it, is if we accept as a society that drugs should be a so-called normal part of life, that some people want to take them and have the right to take them, then should we not also think about the people who are producing the drugs? Who's actually suffering for the drugs that we are enjoying? And that's why there should be, to me, ethically sourced cocaine, ethically sourced drugs in general, which doesn't mean that we encourage everyone to start using cocaine. It means that we understand that this industry is massive and it's enriching cartels. So that would mean in somewhere like Guinea-Bissau, people that I met who are suffering and struggling to produce or at least transit drugs so someone in London can start snorting a line of cocaine, they actually can benefit from that. And that to me is what, in my view, a moral drug policy would look like.
Let's briefly do a detour to Portugal, where the process of decriminalisation is well advanced and harm minimisation policies in place. Working?
Working. Portugal in 2001 decriminalised all drugs, and it was done because then a relatively, not a particularly left-wing government, but a more conservative government was petrified by the fact that HIV rates were going through the roof. Fast forward nearly 20 years and drug use has gone down of all drugs across all ages. Yes, there are still problems in Portugal. There are still issues. The fact that it's decriminalised and not legalised still means that there's obviously a market of people selling drugs. And I would argue it should be a legalised model. But it's sort of amazing to me that a country like that after 20 years, which is a model, it's not perfect, has not in some ways inspired more countries. But Latin American countries, the ones who are suffering the most, what I would love to happen is a country like Bolivia or Colombia to say, you know what, we're going to legalise cocaine. Because we realise that criminalising cocaine, in other words, using it as an example to show to the world that we're not going to continually criminalise people using it and processing it and farming it and allowing, I mean, in Colombia, as listeners might be aware, has the highest rate of cocaine production in the world. In fact, the peace deal is collapsing there and cocaine use around the world soaring. So are we going to militarise that war again, as Trump is wanting to do? That to me is a insane double down on failure.
You also point out in the book that the DEA, the agency which leads the war in what we see in Mexico and elsewhere, has strong parallels with the CIA involvement in Vietnam.
I do, and I do a lot of investigation, in fact, of cases, and I sort of frame this actually very much, although Vietnam obviously was many years ago, but I frame it in some ways in a post-9/11 environment. And what I briefly mean is that since 9/11, the FBI has created thousands and thousands of stories to entrap Muslims to apparently suggest that they're terrorists, and they're in jail for years. The DEA does exactly the same thing. They have on the payroll, Philip, thousands and thousands of people who entrap people. And I met a lot of people who had been entrapped. People who, some of them are good people, some might be bad people, but they're entrapping people to be convinced that they should make drug deals. They get caught, they go to a court in the US, they're put in jail for years and years. And for what? They haven't actually necessarily wanted to deal drugs. The DEA in a moral society would be shut down like the CIA. And although Australia is not as bad as the US, to be sure, successive Australian governments, Labor and Liberal, to be honest, have been, Liberals are worse, but Labor federally right now and for years has been profoundly lacking in any bravery on this issue and don't want to talk about drugs really because they're scared of the tabloid backlash.
Anthony, thanks for this. Anthony Lowenstein's book, Pills, Powder and Smoke, published by Scribe Books. Great to see you again.